From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. About a week ago, a state senator, Senator Aaron Osman, caused a stir when he suggested in a blog post he had written that Utah should consider doing away with a law that requires a public education for young people. Now, it's hard to say just where Mr. Osman was coming from exactly. He's talked about the importance of public education, so this could have been an effort to get the conversation going about reforming the system. But it also seems some of this is political or ideological. He seems suspicious of government taking over a role he says is for parents, not teachers. But wherever he was coming from, the idea has raised some questions worth talking about, which is what we're doing today. We're talking about compulsory education, the history of it, whether it works, whether it's outdated, and what happens if education becomes a choice, not a law. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've become so used to the fact that we have to educate our kids by law that when State Senator Aaron Osman suggested doing away with that law, it got people's attention, like the late-night talk show host Conan O'Brien.
This is crazy. A Utah senator proposed a bill that would no longer require kids to go to school. Yeah. Yeah, but then someone noticed that the senator was just three boys in a trench coat standing on top of each other's shoulders.
Are they buying this?
Now, O'Brien got a few things wrong in the joke. In fact, he got a lot wrong in the joke. Senator Osman hasn't proposed a bill yet. The idea actually came in an essay that he had written on the Senate blog site. But he does say he's working on a bill to possibly present at the next legislative session. So today in the program, we're talking about all of the questions that Senator Osman has raised with his essay. When did we first make it mandatory to educate our young people and why? We'll talk about whether this has worked, this compulsory education law, and what would happen if it wasn't a law? What if it were a choice, an opportunity, as Senator Osman puts it? We'll also work through the arguments for and against it, and we're hoping to hear from you. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I should mention we, of course, invited Senator Osman to join us today, but he's traveling for work over the next 2 weeks, in fact, and wasn't available. But I think we have the next best thing. Paul Merrow was with us, president of the Sutherland Institute. It's a conservative public policy think tank based here in Salt Lake City. He's been calling for an end to compulsory education for more than a decade now. And Paul Merrow, welcome. Thanks for having me, Doug. You're glad to get this conversation going again. It seems like, as we said, you've been thinking about this a long time.
Long time. About a decade ago, we released a publication called Saving Education in Ourselves. And it was really... We subtitled it a moral case for self-reliance in education. And so the issue, if I can maybe get us going.
Yeah,
on
jump
this,
in.
Really,
and I'll work us through a few things. But yeah, go ahead. Go for it.
It's just, you know, it's really what's the best freedom construct here. So in the name of democracy, compulsory education was established as early as 1850-ish, you know, out of Massachusetts it started. And so, we have to ask ourselves, given the history of compulsory education, how it was used by the United States government to assimilate American Indians and so many other new immigrant minorities coming to the country, the cost of that, did it really add value to freedom? And so what we're arguing, what I would argue is that rather than having the American people serve government or some romanticized form of democracy, that perhaps we'd be better off in the freedom construct if we just empowered families again and parents to assume personal responsibility, which I think they have in many cases gladly abrogated especially in a very materialistic economic age, a very prosperous age, you know, where all of a sudden two parents decide, you know what, maybe it's good if both parents were working. No, and I understand a lot of parents don't have those choices like that.
Well, this was clearly a concern of Senator Osman, and we'll get to that. So here's the thing. Is this an ideological concern for you almost more than it is a sort of practical concern, or do they both come together for you?
No, I think they both come together. And despite what folks might think about me, I don't think of myself as an ideologue. So like we argued a decade ago, I think this really is a moral case that we're talking about here. The moral underpinnings of freedom. So, no.
What do you mean by that? In the sense that it ought to be parents, individuals who are making decisions about the values that are being expressed in their education system.
Here's what I'm saying. Yeah, that I'm saying in a free society, yeah, it's kind of an irony that we coerce knowledge, that we coerce education into a thing we call public schools. At a practical level, though, at a public policy level, as you think through that construct, you know, who is best to take responsibility? Well, who's best to take responsibility for feeding people? Who's best to take responsibility for any other normal aspect of life? Yeah. And we're saying it should be parents.
Of course, you know that if you then just rely on parents, that you're going to have people who are going to fall through the cracks and who are practically then not going to get educated.
Yeah. I think
what
there
do you do?
Are more people. Let's, you know, you, first of all, you don't make law on the exception. So, there's always going to be the crack mom or something, you know, that doesn't care about her kids. But that already exists, right?
Yeah.
So what you have to do is if we're just talking practicality now, what you have to do is really reflect on the success of the public school system, period. So, for instance, years ago during the very controversial
Are you being sarcastic, by the way?
No.
Okay. The success of the public education system. Okay.
No, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt.
Okay.
All right, let's go in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, during the very controversial voucher debate, when we were on the side, when Sutherland Institute was on the side of vouchers, you might remember what we argued was that at the time, so 2007, I guess it was, right, 44% of Hispanic school-age children weren't graduating with a regular high school diploma. 44%. Now, if that happened in I don't know where you live, but if that happened in my neighborhood, I guarantee you parents would be up in arms. But for whatever reason, and I'm sure there's a dynamic there, you know, Hispanic kids, maybe on the west side of the valley, maybe on the west side of this city, that's allowable, I guess. But in my mind, it's not. And so if we're talking about what if all of a sudden we got rid of compulsory education? Are you saying that 44% would what? Go to 66% or 88%, or might it go down actually when all of a sudden everybody has responsibility for this?
You're saying it can't get any worse in some level.
I'm saying, well, everything can get worse.
Sure.
We know that. But my guess is that in a free society where risk is part of life, you roll the dice on the side of freedom.
We're going to have Andrea Rohr on the program. She's director of the Utah Education Policy Center at the university. And she says that research is showing that in a system that already has big problems with equity, mm-hmm, whether you like it or not, this mm-hmm is the reality of the system today. Low-income, minority people are struggling. So ending compulsory education, she says, would only make those problems, in fact, worse. She says they can get worse. And so how would ending compulsory education benefit students? You're saying if you change the mindset, which is a term that Senator Osmond has used, that in fact it will refocus parents, that they will get more engaged? I mean,
this is an awful word in this progressive day and age, but you have to stigmatize these roles. I mean, you have to put pressure on people to live up to what the expectation is, not only of an individualized community, but of the broader common good. You know, if our goal is equity, mm-hmm, you're right. Let's force everybody into the factory model and we'll all be equally mediocre, I guarantee you. And in fact, that's kind of the legacy of the public school system is mediocrity. But that is because the progressive mentality is based on equity. You know, what if our mentality was based on opportunity? And opportunity was left up to personal responsibility, knowing full well that we would never get rid of what I would consider to be the safety net of public education. I mean, it exists for a reason, just like we have a normal welfare safety net. We all believe in that, right? Helping our neighbors, lifting our neighbors. But from my conservative perspective, we don't lift our neighbors into an equity position. We lift our neighbors into an opportunity position. And I think that's why in a free society, compulsory education might be the biggest irony that exists.
Hmm. I want to come back to something you had referred to earlier, and this is something you've written about, this idea that right from the get-go, this concept of compulsory education from your perspective was bad and even corrupt. Mm-hmm. You've called these mandatory compulsory attendance laws relics of, here's how you put it, 20th century industrialism, mm-hmm. and nativism.
Yeah.
Explain.
Okay. So compulsory education, again, began just after 1850 in the United States.
And what's going on at the time? Industrialism is kicking in, right?
Well, you're going to hit the Civil War.
Yep.
And the Civil War changes a lot of things, right? But then you really are moving into this pure industrial age in the United States. And we're just talking about factories. I use the term factory model.
Yeah.
Okay. Public education became a tool of industrialists in many locales to put the kids somewhere, frankly, while mom could go to work. We need workers. And in fact, the rhetoric today, if you look at whatever that Prosperity 2020 or whatever we're talking about, I contend that whenever you hear a politician say that we need an educated workforce, all they're hearkening back to is 1880 in the United States, where industrialists were saying, you know, hey, we just need workers, right? We got to grow America. We have to compete with the rest of the world. That's what that sounds like to me. On the other hand, the nativists—
But isn't that a more cynical view to say—
Well, it's a realistic view. I don't know if it's cynical, but it's the truth.
But isn't the other spin of that saying we need a citizenry that is educated so it can be more engaged in civic affairs?
That's different. That's completely different. That's completely different than saying we need workers. You know, I believe in the Jeffersonian model. I believe in it deeply. But the Jeffersonian model is not compulsory education, mm-hmm. and it's certainly not the factory system. But let me address the nativism
part.
Go ahead.
Yes, I want you to.
I was telling your assistant that a colleague of mine and I years ago wrote a piece for BYU Law Review, and I'm blanking on the title. It's like Battlefields in the Classroom, and we wrote about this history about after the Civil War, you had a lot of military who didn't have anything to do, frankly, and they were enlisted by the federal government to assimilate at that point the American Indians, and this is when our government in a free society just forcibly dragged American Indians into camps for assimilation, where they would cut their hair like white people, they would dress them like white people, and then that same mentality rolled over into all of the new immigrant minorities coming to the United States, because of course we have to all be Americans, right? I mean, we have to talk like Americans and look like Americans, and for anybody that ignores that part of history, frankly, when we're talking about compulsory education, they're ignoring a huge cornerstone of why we even have compulsory education.
You mentioned Thomas Jefferson, and you've written about the fact that he envisioned, championed public education like you advocate, like you talk about. But as you say, he never supported compulsory attendance, and you say he would be appalled by the idea. So what's the Jeffersonian concept? What does that look like in society?
Yeah, well, the Jeffersonian concept really was based on the idea that you had to have an educated citizenry to maintain a free society. So what's the best way to do that? And of course, in his prudence, coming off of the American Revolution, the last thing he and his colleagues were going to commit to was forcing the American people into government schools. It just that wasn't even part of how he thought. So again, you know, by 1850, in Massachusetts, you basically had a lot of religious zealots starting to want to assimilate Americans to look and sound like them, which again just shocks me that progressives would assume that identity. It's like what they would call religious bigotry. They assumed.
I wanted to ask you about. Let me ask you this: did Senator Osmond get this from you? Did this come from you? This sounds like you more than him, although I don't know him.
You know, I appreciate that compliment, but you'd have to ask him.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Like here's why I think that.
Yeah.
He talks about local control, and this has been very important for you for a long time.
Yeah.
There is a reason this begins with local control. This is how you've written. Because, as you say, public education is an extension of parental control and values. So the idea, and I should maybe explain what Senator Osmond has said, is let's let the local districts or let this be a, mm-hmm. let's let this idea of what we're teaching be something that comes from local entities, not this broader core curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that resonates with you, this idea that values, that that parental control is very much a local concept.
See, and again, one of the incongruities in this whole public policy is that statute doesn't meet constitutionality. So there's nothing in the Utah Constitution that talks about compulsory education. It just talks about creating a free public school system.
Yeah.
For anybody who's going to participate. But over the years, over the decades, that has morphed in Utah, much like mirroring the rest of the country, where compulsory attendance has basically assumed this constitutional identity or authority when it's not at all. It's just statute. It's just one day, you know. Utahns just said, hey, you know, I just think that's a good idea. The rest of the country's doing it. Why can't we do that? So I'm sorry. I'm lost my thought on that.
Well, no. I mean, I think that this idea of local control was important for you in terms of imposing
exactly.
also a sense of values, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And parental control is the most local control. Look, parents are either responsible for their children or not. The United States Constitution, through court decisions, it's been clear that parents are responsible for the education and upbringing of their children. That's constitutional language upheld since 1921 all the way to right now. There's nothing that is getting in the way of that constitutional language. So we either believe that or not, and if we do, that is ultimate local control. So our public school systems just become an extension of the parental desire to educate their children. The common good comes into play, the public interest comes into play, if you will, in the Jeffersonian model. Nowhere, though, nowhere in either of those constructs for a free society do I see compulsory education, except by those who are pushing it, who I think should be pushed actually to defend it.
We're going to be talking about the early days of the Utah's involvement.
I feel like I'm yelling. Am I yelling?
No, you're not. No,
okay. Because, I mean, we're sitting in this quiet room here and you're 3 feet away from
me. No.
Okay, sorry.
I
get passionate.
Yes, you do. Is it at all persuasive to you or in any way does this at all sway you that the LDS Church in the early days when Utah was considering these compulsory attendance laws was very influenced by this, was very much supportive of it, this idea that education is a common good. It's also a spiritual good and a religious good.
Yeah.
So that speaks to values. Is that persuasive to you?
No, it's not, because we all know the history of the federal government in Utah. And it's no coincidence that in the major Supreme Court decisions in the 1890s that dealt with plural marriage here in Utah – that when the federal government was going to take all of the properties away from the LDS Church, that in the Supreme Court decision, it says that those assets would then be put into the creation of a public school system. The federal government and the progressives at that time in the federal government who really disliked the LDS Church knew what they were doing. They were going to separate children from parents. They were going to basically put them into what you might call during World War II or after the Civil War with the American Indians, re-education camps. You know, so it is I think it's preposterous to say that the LDS Church naturally assumed this compulsory education identity. They didn't. The history is clear in Utah. So in other words, the federal government effectively assimilated Mormons as Americans.
You know, they fit into the Native American nativist concept.
They fit into
your theory.
Absolutely.
The idea that – I mean, you talk about this freedom component, the irony of that.
Mm-hmm.
Wade, one of our listeners, sent an email or he responded via Facebook. I'm not entirely sure right now to point out that, in fact, there is choice, Paul. There's choice. You can pull your kids out and put them in private school.
Correct.
You can homeschool them
right.
if you like. I mean, there are plenty of different options. It's not like there isn't a kind of choice.
Yeah, but you need to
–
this gentleman and others would need to understand that when compulsory ed was adopted as part of the new education religion, all of these options weren't there. We have fought long and hard to open up educational choice.
But don't those represent a fact that there has been some disentangling with that? That you don't see those as
all it represents
not
is,
enough.
All it represents is politics to me. It represents that the pressure cooker heats up and politicians need a way to get constituents off their backs. When I got to Sutherland Institute back in December of 2000, you know, you still basically as a homeschool family, which we were with our six kids all their lives. You had to get permission from the state to do that, to be a parent, to educate your kids. You had to get permission. And so in my position and with the passion that I have on that issue, you know, we're able to get the legislature to see the light and we changed the homeschool laws. You know, so now there is cooperation for sure. And coordination. You know, homeschool kids can come in and out of the public school system, and public school kids can go to homeschooling.
Hmm.
That didn't exist 15 years ago.
I wonder, let's say Senator Osmond is able to, you know, draft some legislation, get it presented. Will he get traction on this? Do you think that this is something that could go somewhere?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm practical about all of this. I've been working on this for 10 years, although it hasn't been a huge priority for us. We just try to make the point and appeal to people's better sides. But no, I think the Utah Education Association, I think all of the education stakeholders in public education require compulsion. That's their power base. And where there's power in this state, there's money. And so they're going to fight. They'll all do it in the name of this romanticized version of democracy. That's all they'll talk about. But the reality is that it's about power and money.
Let me ask you one more thing. And this question of the underprivileged being served in terms of them having access to education comes up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You say that on a practical – here's – you write this on a practical level. Eliminating compulsory attendance laws would serve the cause of freedom and it would enhance a just society.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what you say that which is going to rankle.
Okay.
It would free Utahns from the clutches of special interests such as the business community that only seeks its own welfare and from progressive do-gooders who constantly look to save, in quotation, mm-hmm. minority populations from their assumed victimhood.
Yeah, which is just an extension of the historical model for compulsory education, industrialism, and back then it was nativism. Fear. Today, with the progressives, it's more like, well, we have to save the minority population. I need to just share a quick story with you. So during the voucher debate, we're down at Utah Valley. It wasn't university then, whatever that was.
Yeah,
and having a debate on vouchers, I brought up the 44% of Hispanic kids who don't graduate with a normal diploma. Debate's over, and the president of the UEA walks over to me, and she says, you know, that's kind of a specious argument. I said, really? And she says, yeah, you know, and I promise you, even though this is just he said and maybe she said, I'm telling you the truth. She said, you know, their parents don't care. And in fact, that rung with me so much that I talked to a friend, John Flores, who writes a column for the Deseret News. I told him that story, and he said, Paul, every parent cares. So we started a program at Sutherland called Every Parent Cares, where we went to West Side Salt Lake schools and went in there and tried to help parents, especially undocumented immigrant parents, get more involved. So, you know, there is this progressive, elitist, it's not racism, but it's bigoted in every sense that somehow there are parents who really aren't responsible. And I'm talking about, of course, competent people. I'm not talking about mentally incompetent people. Every parent cares. And I think it's just elitist to say that parents in minority populations don't care as much about their kids as others. They might not have the resources to do what you or I might be able to do with our children in education. But that's why we do have public schools, and that's why I'm supportive of the public school system in that aspect. But again, is it to seek equity? By the way, that'll never happen. But is it to seek opportunity? And that's my motivation.
It's Paul Merrill. He is the president of the Sutherland Institute, which has published a paper called Saving Education and Ourselves. There's a link to it on our website. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Doug, thanks so much.
RadioWest.KUER.org is the email address. You can call us at 801-585-WEST. We need to take a break, though. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about compulsory attendance or compulsory education, this idea that you're required by law to get an education. And it's been a law in this state for a long time, more than 100 years, in fact. But recently, State Senator Aaron Osmond suggested Utah rethink that compulsory part. And we're talking about the questions that – fundamental questions, really, that he's raised about all of this. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Tracy Steffes, who teaches education and history at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. She's the author of the book School, Society, and State, which looks at the history of American education in the late 19th and early 20th century, when all of this was going on, by the way. She's joining us from the studios of Rhode Island Public Radio. And Professor Steffes, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a story, one that you tell in your book, right at the beginning of the book, really, that kind of illustrates how emotional this issue of compulsory education can be from time to time, but also how the state was really determined in these early days to assert its authority. It's about this young boy named, I think it's Edward DeLeese, his mother, Elma. She refuses to obey this, you know, new compulsory education law. This is 1916. Will you say something about that story?
Sure. Yeah, I opened the book with it, and Edward DeLeese had missed something like 30 days of school in the past several months, and so the truant officer in town visited him at home when he missed another day, and neighbors reported that he was in town and did not appear to be sick. So when the officer talked with his mother claimed he was sick, but the boy didn't appear to be. So the officer first tried to persuade her to send him to school. And when that failed, actually physically assaulted her, literally ripping Edward out of her arms, injuring her in the process and taking him to school. So it's a very, very overt form of coercion, not a common form of enforcement of compulsory attendance. But it reflects some of the conflicts at its moment of origin.
Yeah. I mean, this story explains how these laws were changing public education, because you point out in the book, in the 19th century, schooling was not the only way that parents educated their children. There were a lot of ways to sort of get them educated.
Right. Children were educated in work. Children were educated in the home through church and community. But school was very important as well. And in the 19th century, a lot of communities no longer felt that these other means of education were adequate and put additional resources into constructing public schools. But throughout the 19th century, attendance at the schools was voluntary. They were created as a supplement to these other forms of education to aid parents.
I wanted to ask you, what did society, look like in those days, in the days before all of this? And I'm thinking of all those important markers like, voting and civic engagement and, industrial power and influence and maybe even math and science scores. I mean, where did we stack up in the context of all of that? Can you say?
Yeah, so the pushes for expansion of education, including the construction of public education and then the creation of compulsory attendance laws and development of attendance policies, all mapped on to moments of change in the United States, particularly democratization. So the first push for public funding and control of education, the foundation of public education systems, came in the same era where the vote was expanded to all white men. And in the late 19th and early 20th century, when compulsory attendance laws were expanded and the first effective forms of enforcement put into place, it's a moment of increased immigration, urbanization, and economic change, and a lot of anxieties then about citizenship and suffrage and assimilation.
This is an important point you make in your book, that Americans did not have to be dragged kicking and screaming to mandatory education. I mean, they didn't see education as a burden imposed on, resistant taxpayers. You say they chose education. They wanted it.
Right. Compulsory attendance laws and policies, and we should probably distinguish between the two, because the first statutes had no enforcement mechanisms. It was really not till this period of 1890 to 1920 when laws were extended, and for the first time there were efforts and techniques of enforcement. So that's really the foundation of the modern period of attendance, the kinds of laws we have today. But this followed the massive voluntary expansion of schools. And in fact, compulsion was only possible because so many parents already chose to send their kids to school. And so it really did target the resistant minority, and it targeted regularizing attendance. So one of the quiet things that attendance policies did that I think is really important is that it not only brought some kids into school who hadn't been there before, but probably much more significantly, it regularized and disciplined the attendance of people who were already enrolled. It wasn't uncommon for people to attend very irregularly,
right.
But attendance policies made daily regular attendance for the full term a new and important norm.
What is it? It seems like a lot of this sort of kicked into gear after World War I. What was it about about that World War that seemed to be so powerfully influential in all of this?
So there was a very big discussion after World War I about the educational deficiencies that it revealed. People were particularly concerned about reports coming out of the Army about draft statistics, men who were examined for the draft and dismissed as unfit, either because they were illiterate or because they had health or physical defects that prevented them from serving. And the numbers were shockingly high. It was something like 25% illiteracy and almost 50% physical or health defects, about half of those so severe that it prevented service. And people argued that this was an indictment of education, particularly because the rates among native-born white students and in rural areas was much higher than people expected. And so it created a tremendous discussion right after the war and a lot of education reforms, including the extension of compulsory attendance policies, but also new forms of state aid, new forms of minimum teacher salary laws and raising teacher certification standards, changes in curriculum, including civics instruction and health education and physical education, and new health policies like inspections of eyes and ears and medical inspection.
Yeah. Where does Utah fit in all of this? Because you've talked about how Utah really went further than most.
Yeah, Utah was a leader, particularly after World War I. In 1919, as part of this wave of education reform, Utah passed the most ambitious compulsory attendance law in the nation. It had been mandatory to attend school until age 16 in Utah and many other states, although some had lower attendance ages than that. And Utah changed it to age 18. It allowed exemptions for students who were ages 16 to 18 if they were working full-time, but they had to attend part-time schooling in order to claim the work exemption. So it really expanded the expectations that students would stay in school effectively to high school graduation. And it was an ambitious law at the time because only there wasn't nearly enough high school facilities to accommodate all of the high school-age students in the state at the time. So it resulted in a massive high school building program, and rates of high school attendance doubled in Utah within the next 5 years.
Wow. You know, I wonder how you were responding or thinking about what Paul Merrow was saying about, you know, I mentioned that the LDS Church had a powerful influence over a lot of those laws. And, you know, he said, this was just the government manipulating, a population base that it was trying to get assimilated into. You know, that to that particular question, but also to his general argument that this was a nativist thing. And I mean, what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say that government is a little problematic. Schools are among the most decentralized of institutions we have. And one of the things I look at in the book is the wide array of people that are involved in education reform. It's very difficult for any one group to dominate all aspects of schooling and impose an agenda. And particularly when we're talking about government and attendance policy, it's a state statute that's passed, but enforcement is delegated to districts, which means it's individual communities that decide whether and how to enforce policies. And so this isn't a federal government imposed effort to dominate a particular population as so much as a top down and especially a bottom up movement that occurs in all of the states around the same time and in a number of nations. The United States is one of many that are seeing compulsory attendance policies as a natural extension of universal education. On the second point on nativism, I would say there were certainly aspects of nativism, and there were some proponents of compulsory attendance who were motivated primarily by nativism.
Right.
But again, I would say it's problematic to say that this was the dominant goal or the goal of all groups. There were a lot of different groups who supported compulsory attendance laws. People interested primarily in child welfare and doing it for humanitarian reasons. Others interested in solving social problems. Many argued that poverty, crime, and immorality would be significantly decreased because of the moralizing effects of education. Others saw it an issue of national progress and efficiency and welfare. And others argued it was just more efficient. The public was spending a lot of money for schools and should make sure that students use them.
Let me get another voice involved in the conversation. Andrea Rohr is with us, director of the Utah Education Policy Center. It's a research group at the University of Utah. She also teaches educational leadership and policy. And thanks for being with us. Welcome.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So how are you reacting to this? I mean, I guess this sort of thing ebbs and flows. You hear it on the fringes from time to time. Paul Merrow, you probably heard it when he brought it up 10 years ago. He brings it up from time to time. Now a state senator is bringing it up. Does that make you feel worried, or what do you make of it?
Not worried at this point. I think Mr. Merrow is right in that it wouldn't have much traction right now in the state, particularly given the focus of the governor and the State Office of Education and the business community on ensuring the economic prosperity of the state. So doing away with the opportunity for more students to be more knowledgeable and be active and engaged in our citizenry is unlikely to occur. I am encouraged that part of the focus in Senator Aaron Osmond's blog was on what I interpret as the professionalization of teaching. And if it reignites attention to how we can ensure the professionalization of teaching, then I think this discussion is positive. If we can refocus our efforts on what kind of compensation and benefits are necessary for teachers, what kind of development is necessary, what opportunities would they have to provide education for the students that are attending their schools, I think that's positive. If it refocuses our attention on both the quality of the educational experience as well as the access and the subsequent outcomes and opportunities, then I think this discussion serves a great purpose in the state, particularly given our goals.
But is that where he's coming from? I mean, can you tell where he's coming from? Because, you know, it's interesting. I mean, on one hand, he's been fairly supportive of public education. He's
He's
very conservative, though, as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're hearing the sort of Paul Merrow strands in what he's saying as well. You know, this concern for freedom, this concern for choice, the imposition of the nanny state and government and all this kind of stuff. Where is he coming from? Can you tell?
I cannot. I take the same position in that Senator Osmond has been hugely supportive of public education, increasing educator effectiveness, looking at how we increase access. So the blog maybe is not representative of all that was considered and thought about around this issue of compulsory education. I think that we have to be careful, though, as a state with regard to comments made about we want to give options for parents who are interested and not interested. And Mr. Murrow said a few things that I took a little bit contradictory with regard to who would send their children to school and who's interested, and then later comments about everybody's interested.
Be more specific. What do you mean?
So there are comments in several of the blogs and responses with regard to some parents are not interested in educational opportunities
for their
students.
What does that mean, do you think? Well, how do you read that? Some parents are not interested.
I interpret that as people looking at the parent down the street or across the valley as not being interested. And I've been in education since 1989 as a teacher, a principal, state office educator, and now at the university for the last, I think, 12 years. I've yet, in any of my interactions, interviews, as a practitioner, wherever, I've never met a parent, regardless of their home status, whether it be around wealth or language, race, that is not interested in the education and educational opportunities for their child and the children around them. And so I think when we start putting out arguments that there are some parents who aren't concerned, and so let's reserve the energy of educators for those who not only are their students interested, but the parents are willing to support too, I think that leads us down a detrimental path for who's going to have access and who's going to have the quality of opportunities and who's going to have the life chance to actually participate as a part of the citizenry here in the state and nation.
So you're hearing Paul speak out of both sides of his mouth in some ways. I mean, in one hand, he's saying it's those parents, but then everyone loves their – everyone cares, I think it was the refrain that he mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Before, and you're hearing a little bit of
I heard a bit of contradiction.
Yes,
and that's not unlike this terrain around compulsory education. Mr. Murrow referred to homeschooling, and certainly that has been one contested area around compulsory education and who has control over the education of a particular child or the curriculum or what they're exposed to.
Tracy Steffes, let me ask you. You've said that this conversation seems to have shifted. I mean, your focus is sort of kind of for history before – well, not kind of. It's history before the 1940s. But you do talk about – I do want you to sort of fit it in the context of today. I mean, because you've talked about how the conversation has shifted rather than it being about a public good and having a public purpose. Are you hearing language about being at a private good, a private benefit?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's striking about the discussion in the early 20th century is that all of the rationales came back down to the social and public functions of education, that we need compulsory attendance laws because it's a problem for the public and for democracy to have uneducated citizens for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
In the discussions today, a lot of the discussion about the aims of education is framed more in terms of the individual benefits for the child, in terms of economic opportunity or social mobility. And while those are important, I think what's sometimes missing is the sense of the public importance. So at the same time, the discussion in the early 20th century was about the need for compulsory attendance because the interests of the parent and child weren't always the same.
Right.
The children had the right to an opportunity regardless, or even if their parents were not providing it for them, and that the public had an interest in ensuring this opportunity. And in Mr. Morrow's comments, it's almost entirely about parents' rights. There's not very much about opportunity for the child or the child's rights.
Here's an email. Roy writes, "Woe unto those who choose this course if the ensuing crop of youngsters is unemployable and dysfunctional in a postmodern world." He writes, "The harsh reality is that those decision makers truly will not care, as their immediate reason in opting out appears to be the short-sighted goal of not having to pay taxes for the public school system in the present. Pockets of intellectual regression in places like Utah and Idaho seem to give the impression that the social values of the 19th century century-old South seem to have migrated to the 21st century New West. This is one time I hope to be wrong." Anything in there resonate for you, Andrea Rohr, this idea that we have – we're in a digital age. We have an – you know, you always hear about this heck – you know, youngsters being unemployable and dysfunctional. I mean, do we need this kind of thing more now than ever before? I mean, how do you respond to something like that?
I think we do. And again, compulsory education, and as Dr. Steff has clarified the difference between that and compulsory education and compulsory attendance.
Right.
What we know is that as students come through school, for example, if they're not attending school, they're increasing their rates and potential for dropping out of school. And that just exacerbates over time. And so this opportunity we have, as the emailer said, to look at the West and what are we going to look like, I think there are opportunities for us to refocus our energy on what education is going to look like and for what purpose, as Dr. Steff has said, both the individual and societal. And I think Utah is well poised for that, particularly with the energy we have at all levels. Dr. Steff has also mentioned top-down, bottom-up, educators as well as policymakers, decision makers, to focus on the variety of ways that we can improve education through technology, through distance learning, through charter schools, through opportunities within the public, the other traditional public school settings, to actually expose students to more that's going to prepare them in ways not to meet necessarily the demands of today, but more importantly, the demands of what our society and business is going to need when they're actually in that realm 5-10 years from now.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Patrick is with us in Salem. Patrick, welcome.
Hi, I'm a high school teacher, and, you know, the problem I see is everything in education has boiled down to being based on coercion. We have to coerce our students to come, which fundamentally changes the paradigm which they come with. Teachers are seen as failing because kids aren't learning by choice, so we have to coerce them with top-down mandates, and then states are failing, so the federal government has to use coercion. And fundamentally, compulsory education changes the environment of public schools from one that, you know, where the students would come at for their own benefit if they had choice. But now all of a sudden, everything is, you know, they're forced to. And it's not consistent with human behavioral theory.
Let me get a response to Andrew Rohr. You start this idea that, and you've heard this before, that mm-hmm. and it's what Senator Osmond himself has talked about. Let's change the perspective, not forcing them, but using it as an opportunity. Change our language, change our perspective. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think the evidence shows us, particularly in Utah, that a majority of students actually are attending schools. So it's actually the smaller percentage of students who might be chronically absent, for example, or what some refer to later on as truant. And so I think we have a captive audience of individuals who show up each day who actually want to be there. The next question is, for those who don't attend, maybe are our focus can be, why aren't they attending, and what do we need to – how do we need to support them to support our neighborhoods and our community?
You did this study last year on chronic absenteeism in Utah. What do we know about the kids who are most likely to miss a lot of school? Because wasn't the focus on kindergarten?
The focus with my colleague in the Policy Center, Kristen Swenson, was actually on the state of Utah and looking at all students.
Right.
What we found is that, for example, kindergartners are as chronically absent as 10th graders. In fact, we don't match as a state the same rate of chronically absent students. That's 10% of the school year, 18 days or more across the year, until they get back in 10th grade. Well, as you know, generally the age of kindergarten falls outside of the realm of our compulsory education age, which starts at age 6.
Yeah.
So we also found that homeless students, students in conditions where they're in shelters, for example, are more likely to be chronically absent from school. So they're not able to attend for a variety of reasons. And we found that there are basically no gender differences between students who are chronically absent and those who are not. And we found that with regard to what are the predictors, if you will, of being chronically absent, it was socioeconomic status. Hmm. Now, we don't have any information that tells us why at this point they're chronically absent and missing school. But we can turn to other disciplines for information for why students may not be in school. And so the big aha for us, and we're working with groups like the After School Network, for example, to look at extended learning opportunities and what will bring students to school and support them. One of our big findings is the fact that for those students who are chronically absent, we have a vast opportunity to actually have them in school and support them if we're attentive to that, particularly around middle school and then later on in high school. But what we didn't find is that a majority of students aren't showing up. So that leads me to believe that the argument about students are coerced to come to school doesn't necessarily hold the water or weight in these kinds of debates, because the majority of students are actually attending school on a regular basis and not because they're concerned, as Dr. Steph has mentioned, as it was earlier in the previous centuries, that someone's going to come to their house and rip them out of their mother's arms.
Right. So, let me, Dr. Steph, let me come to you finally on this. And this is probably, well, I know it's an unfair question to ask because it's such an expansive question and we've got about a minute or so left. But you say there's a charitable way of reading the Osmond essay, Senator Osmond's essay, that he does make an important point about how schools should step back and parents should step up. Say something about that finally, because I think that is something everyone can agree on.
I'm not sure how much schools should step back, but I think he points to the issue of parental engagement and involvement in the school.
Right.
And, you know, one could read his essay as assuming that if coercion is taken out, parents are going to feel more empowered. And I think parental empowerment is very important for children's education, but we should find ways to foster that within the system that we have. And one final point, if this is the last thing I get to say, I would just say that the only, I think, freedom that compulsory attendance impinges is the right of parents not to educate their children altogether. They can send them to private schools, they can educate them at home. And I think most people agree that the right not to educate is not necessarily something we should protect.
Tracy Steffes, author of School, Society, and State, an assistant professor at Brown University. Andrea Rohr, director of the Utah Education Policy Center at the University of Utah. Thank you both for being with us.
We've
had a lot of comments, so go to our website. You can see them and contribute your own. RadioWest@KUER.org. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.